Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. This morning, host Craig LeBeau talks with Alex Martinez, a field organizer with the Kansas ACLU, about why it is important for undocumented immigrants to be issued IDs. Before that, host Keith Brownell talks with Jeff Francis and Rashad Larte about local and national efforts to elect progressive prosecutors in an effort to stem mass incarceration. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now to Keith Brownell and his guests.
Good morning and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownell. The crisis in the criminal justice system continues to plague our communities in many ways. Some examples of this are mass incarceration, abuse and mistreatment of incarcerated persons, police brutality, and unjustified uses of deadly force, bogus arrests and multiple charges for one alleged offense, incompetent legal representation by paid attorneys, public defenders, and appeal lawyers, wrongful convictions of innocent persons, and other bad faith prosecutions. People being forced to plead guilty simply to avoid unjust convictions and long prison sentences, and the disproportionate number of African Americans being targeted, deliberately targeted, by law enforcement. One of the leading contributing causes to the criminal justice crisis is the gross misuse of authority by local prosecutors and district attorneys. These officials blatantly disregard and outright defy the American Bar Association's fundamental code of conduct, which provides that state attorneys have a responsibility to prosecute cases fairly and justly and not merely to win at all costs. Last month, on Saturday, September 29th, Missouri Cure, also known as Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants, held workshops at our annual statewide conference here in Kansas City. These workshops were designed to examine the issues and try to find solutions to these problems. And so today in the studio with me, I have two gentlemen who conducted one of those workshops at our conference. We have Brother Rashad Larte and Brother Jeff Francis. Also on the phone, we have Ms. Hetty Harden from St. Louis, Missouri, who is the chairperson of Missouri Cure. Good morning, Ms. Harden.
Good morning.
Could you tell us a little bit about the conference we had in Kansas City here last month?
Our conference in Kansas City was on September 29th at the Mohart Multipurpose Center, and I believe it was probably our best one yet. We were commemorating 28 years of struggle in Missouri through Missouri Cure, which started in 1990. We had workshops. We had a keynote speaker from Chicago. We had awards, we had entertainment, free lunch. We had Frank Chapman from Chicago, who was a Missouri prisoner during the 60s and 70s, and now works with the Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression in Chicago. They're doing a great job in fighting police brutality, and they are working to get citizens commissioned controlling the police.
Okay, and what was the main focus of the theme of this conference?
The theme of the conference was stop hating the criminals, start hating the system that creates criminals.
Okay, and can you elaborate on that a little bit? Why should we stop hating the criminals and start hating the system that produces the criminals?
Well, it's the system actually that creates the conditions for crime to occur. The system is what keeps people in the black communities poor, without jobs, without education, without hope, and it's also poor whites and other minorities, and actually creates crime.
Okay. Brother Jeff, could you give us your take on that situation?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the workshop myself. And you know, when I was released from prison, there wasn't any support groups out there available for those who had been incarcerated. And that conversation, it was a conversation that I had to spark and other people who had been in prison with me. And being that I was incarcerated for a wrongful conviction, that was even a greater challenge, an uphill challenge for me, because I was incarcerated in my young life. And when I was released, I was an adult, a full-grown adult. And I believe that, you know, the system, when we look at the system that produces the criminals, and we're looking at crimes of, you know, commercial crimes, and we're looking at how our system actually preys on its citizens, and it uses these criminal behaviors, or they criminalize a lifestyle just for commerce and to support an economy. And we don't realize how these different edifices in our community, how they affect the future of our children and generations to come.
All right, Brother Rashad, could you give us your take on the situation?
Absolutely, man. I'm just honored to be a part of it and honoring George Jackson at this celebration, but generally also wanting to echo the fact that slavery was never abolished. It was evolved. It was revised to include the conviction of a crime, rather that be a wrongful conviction or not, the conviction of a crime. And then following that, the lack of rehab, the lack of self-development, that compounds some of the social and economic issues that landed people in jail. Like Brother Francis said, some of the commercial crime, where I'm aiming to get a few quick dollars, not to really solve the community issue, was the reason why I couldn't help but be there. When the call came to come out and support, I was there on tops.
Are you familiar, either of you familiar with the Real Justice Initiative that was started by this brother, Sean King, who is out of New York? He's a commentator. And if you could you just tell us a little bit about that, if either one of you know anything about this?
The Real Justice, I'm not familiar with the Real Justice. As close as I'm familiar with, the only programs, like I say, aimed towards for helping seeking justice for inmates and convicted persons would be Citizens United for the Reversal of Errants and the FAM Grant, Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Mm-hmm. And it was another one against the death penalty. It was a group that was against the death penalty. And those were the few groups that championed the causes of the inmate.
Okay, how about
Absolutely.
You, Rashawn?
I'm not as familiar with the Real Justice Initiative, but I have followed Sean King and a number of his commentaries related to the brash of legal lynchings that have ongoing.
Okay, now, well, maybe I need
to... I can speak to that a little bit.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Harden, please.
Okay, the Real Justice Initiative, which started with Sean King, is an effort to get rid of bad prosecutors throughout the country and to replace them with more progressive ones. Prosecutors are the most powerful entity in this country. They have the power to charge people with crime and decide what crime or crimes to charge them with. And so it's imperative that we get some more progressive people in there, such as in St. Louis, we recently elected a young progressive black man named Wesley Bell, who's straight out of Ferguson, and defeated longtime prosecutor Bob McCullough. He was in for 27 years and sent many, many people to prison and to death row, and preyed on the black community. But when he preyed on the people of Ferguson after Michael Brown was killed, a movement rose up. He actually tried to cover up the killing of Michael Brown by a police officer. And people just organized and decided to get rid of him, and that's what they did. So
and the police,
that's a good example.
And the police officer,
throughout the country.
The police.
I think it started in Philadelphia or in Pennsylvania with a prosecutor.
And the police officer that was involved with the killing of Michael Brown, his name was Darren Wilson. Is that correct?
Right, right, Darren Wilson. And in fact, McCullough, I mean, he thought he was invincible. He could never be taken out. And recently, actually right before the election, he was at a national prosecutor's convention, and he started talking about, he showed a picture of, I think, five young black males and said, this is what I have to deal with. And a great number of people, actually, prosecutors, actually walked out and talked bad about him later.
Mm-hmm.
So no one is invincible, and people do have power. And the his defeat was a very much a people's victory.
Yes, and we've had a number of other prosecutors that's been unseated throughout the country since this Real Justice Initiative started. And this is really where the focus should be, is that on these prosecutors, because they are the linchpin in all of the injustices that take place all across the country. They had, I think, one of the first people that got into office running on a progressive campaign was a district attorney in Philadelphia named Larry Krasner, and he wrote up a memo that dealt with all of the changes that he was going to make. And the system is so dead set against making these changes and eliminating some of the abuses that have been taking place in the system that this man actually received a lot of death threats on his life from police officers and everybody else because he was trying to change the system. And we have also had this problem here in Kansas City, not to the extent that we've had it in St. Louis and some of the other places, but we've had a number of cases that have been wrongly prosecuted and convicted. People have been convicted. You know, we had the case of Ricky Kidd. We had the case of Keith Corns. We had the case of Robert Nelson. And we just have a whole list of people that we could go on naming of people that obviously they were innocent of their crimes. And the state didn't care. They used the authority that they had to prosecute these people and put them in jail and try to keep them there. Once these people go to jail, it becomes obvious that they did not commit the crimes. The state continues to fight to keep these people incarcerated. You know, and so
right.
We have to start trying to bring awareness to people and make them understand that a lot of people don't even know who the district attorney is or the prosecutor is in their county. They don't pay any attention to when their name appears on the ballots. And a lot of them have been virtually running unopposed. You know, so we have to start finding some.
They don't pay any attention until they or their family become targeted.
Exactly. So we have to start going around looking for viable candidates to run against these people and people who are committed to trying to prosecute cases fairly. I mean, you know, every time we try to do this, we have people that try to make it seem like, oh, we just want to get all the criminals out of jail. We want to let murderers and rapists and all this type of stuff out of society. We want to get people out of jail who should not be there because they're innocent of their crimes or because they have been there long enough to be rehabilitated. If there is no hope for rehabilitation, then why do we have to keep spending all this money on these rehabilitation programs when we put these people in prison and then we don't ever want to let them out?
So what I hear you saying is, you know, the warehousing of our citizens. We're warehousing citizens in the criminal justice system. And like Miss Hetty, as she spoke about addressing solutions. And it starts with the conversation. Is there a problem in the first place? Mm-hmm. Yes, there is a problem. And the conversation itself, people have been running from. And so now that we address that there is a problem, there is a need for Real Justice Initiative, now we start centering our focus around these different programs that can help. And just like how you say, when we're talking about elected officials, and that was one of the things that came out in our workshop, we had three key components that we had spoke about: reaching out to elected officials and appointed officials, communication with inmates, and the bonding of inmates. And we'll, and Brother Rashad, and he'll be able to expound on that, but I think it's very important that we highlight the different programs, organizations, as well as individuals who are standing up and speaking up for these injustices. Because Because without outside of the conversation and outside of the support of the groups, then the conversation itself, it doesn't have any legs, and we don't have the impact and the effect that we desire.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to speak even more life into this reality, as we came out of that workshop that me and Brother Jeff did, and we were sitting down talking with people who were families of incarcerated men and women. So it was personal. And as we said, the first thing, reaching out to elected officials, includes, I argue, reaching down into law schools, into law school programs where you can find people that have just graduated and are looking for a niche in the legal field. In terms of communicating with the inmates, writing letters, establishing pen pal programs, celebrating birthdays and other achievements of rehab in that desert of rehabilitation. And then lastly, bonding inmates. There are a variety of bonding programs, from plumbing to woodworking to house building and maintenance, that these men and women can get certified on, so when they come out, they're not still in that, again, that economic abyss of where you have to check that box and deal with that real racial and economic reality coming out as a whether you're wrongfully convicted or you still have served your time. They treat you as if you don't have the same rights.
And we also have to have programs like that for people who haven't fallen into the criminal justice system yet, because they have to be able to have the ability to avoid falling into the traps that are set by the system, the traps of poverty and things of this nature. But if we get the right prosecutors in office, the right people in these key positions, we can stop a lot of people and prevent them from going to prison in the first place. That's where the emphasis needs to be put on, because the way the system is set up now, nobody's safe. I just read a list of injustices and issues of misconduct that in my introduction that dealt with all the tricks and the wrongs that are done as you go into this criminal justice system. We have to find people who are willing to correct those injustices. And right now we need another prosecutor right here in Jackson County. But we haven't found a viable candidate, but we serving them with notice that we are going to be looking for somebody.
That's right.
And if you don't straighten your act, or you don't get your act together, we coming for your head.
I like what happened over in Wyandotte County with Mark Dupree. I like the fact that he was bold and courageous enough to establish a conviction integrity unit. Mm. Because when we're talking about real justice, and we're talking about seeking out justice and talking about wrongful convictions, it leaves a stain on the robe of the magistrate who presides over the case, as well as the prosecutor who maliciously pursues the prosecution. And sometimes it's also wrapped up in deals with our defense attorneys. Mm. So the integrity of our officials and our representation, that's where it has to start. Like you say, we may have to dig down into these college campuses and some of these new lawyers or aspiring lawyers and legal minds to come out, and this is the work that they can tend to, because everybody in prison is not innocent, just like everyone in prison is not guilty.
Exactly.
So we have to create an allowance, and through a conviction integrity unit, that is very important, because if you have someone sitting in prison for a wrongful conviction, that means the actual perpetrator is still free. And then when you send this person to prison and you warehouse them and you don't give them the necessary rehabilitation, and you don't address different issues, whether it's addiction, whether it's education, literacy, employment, trades and skills, those are the things that those are like edifices that produces the criminal element. And so we have a market. Everybody is available for this market. It's either the job market or the crime market.
Yeah.
And
very, very well said.
And this is what a lot of people don't understand, is that prison is a very profitable business. It used to be a time when people didn't want prisons in their community.
Yeah.
But now every time they get ready to build another prison, you got the people in those communities, they go to the legislature and they lobby to have prisons because it does so much for the community. I've been in some of these little small towns where they didn't hardly have anything, and they build a prison there. You look up, and a couple of years later, you got health spas, you got major shopping centers and all these type of things.
Hotels
and everything just spring up out of nowhere.
So you know? It sounds like you're telling me there's benefits to the crime market.
Exactly. And they could use those same benefits to give people jobs out on the street and create employment resources without having to build these prisons. But it's easier to lock people up and make slaves out of them, because once you put people in prison, you can charge them. You can pay them almost nothing for the labor that you would have to pay people out on the street. We have a building down here, right here in the heart of Kansas City, called the AT&T building. That building sits empty. Nobody is in it because they contracted the labor out to people incarcerated. When you talk to people on the phone, a lot of times you don't even know. And not necessarily saying that they do that here in Missouri, but through having these contracts with other states, they were able to. You can go all over the state of Missouri, and I imagine it's like that elsewhere and all over the country. You got AT&T buildings shut down that stand empty, because they are using prison labor. They can pay these prisoners
5 cents,
5 or 10 cents an hour, or $15 to $20 a month to do a job that they would have to pay somebody $300 or $400 or a month, or $500 or $600 or $700 a month to do out on the street.
And I think that speaks exactly to the solution that we mentioned of giving these men and women these certifications. If you've been in and you've been down doing this skill, that someone outside gets paid thousands of dollars, $20,000, $40,000 a year to do, there's no reason why you shouldn't come out, be qualified, be certified, and be able to go into business, or at least sell your skill.
Also the issue of taking human resources out of the black community when you're putting a lot of black people in prison for years and decades. And then you're putting the resources in the rural communities where you're building the prisons and building up their economy, while the black community just dies.
And also, one of the focuses that we had at the conference is the inhumane and the barbaric treatment that prisoners have to suffer in these communities. Most of these prisons are in rural communities. And when you mistreat people and you abuse them, there is no hope for rehabilitation once you release them. But they know that the majority of these people that they are mistreating and they abusing, they're not going to go back to these rural communities. They're coming back to Kansas City. They're coming back to St. Louis. They're going to have a grudge against society. And people in these communities are going to be the people who end up being the victims. You know, the Department of Corrections, they claim to be aware of all this. They have something on their website where they talk about, I forgot what it said, but it was exactly in the nature of what I was speaking of. But yet these abuses continue to occur, you know. And then when you contact these people and you bring them complaints and you show them, well, we need names. Well, if you give them names, then people are going to be retaliated against, mm-hmm. you know. And they already know these things are going on, you know. So we have to be careful about how we try to deal with these type of situations. But we have to learn that we have to treat people with humane. Even you may, regardless of the fact that you may have been guilty of a crime, regardless of the fact of how unacceptable your behavior might have been that caused you to be sent to prison, you still are entitled to be treated like a human being. This is the only way you're going to get your point across to other people, make them understand that, hey, you have to learn how to treat people the way you have been treated.
Yeah, I agree. And so I just wanted to make sure that we remind everyone the focus is to stop blaming the criminals and to blame the system that creates the criminals. We're talking about prosecutorial misconduct, over-sentencing, overcharging, who regulates and who really prosecutes the prosecutors, and the Real Justice Initiative to go out to reach down into law schools, high schools, future graduating legal minds, and to get them to realize we need to reframe and replace all of the nation's prosecutors.
And on that note, we're out of time. And I thank you, gentlemen, for your participation in this program. And let's continue to work toward these goals.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, and you, Ms. Harden.
Now the calendar for the week of October 29th. Corey's network invites survivors of murder for their weekly workshops to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop, not a grief group. We will be having guest speakers and will candidly discuss how to survive and thrive after losing someone we love. You should bring something to take notes with, and please include only those individuals mature enough in age to deal with issues being covered during the meeting. The next workshop, Beginning the Journey, will be held Monday, October 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Kansas City, Missouri. The church is located east of the Hy-Vee at 40 Highway and Nolan Road. For more information and a listing of future workshops, please call 816-834-9161 or email Corey's Network, that's C-O-R-E-Y-S, network at gmail.com. 21 kids and adults, that's young adults, are suing the U.S. government over its failure to take action on global warming and pollution and to preserve a livable climate for them and their children. The U.S. federal court in Eugene, Oregon, is scheduled to hear the case starting today. You can show your support for this at a rally today at 4:30 p.m. That's Monday, October 29th, 4:30 today, at the University Playhouse on the UMKC campus, 700 East 51st Street in Kansas City, Missouri. The Kansas City Area Chapter of Parents and Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting Friday, November 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, Kansas City, Missouri. POMC meets to provide assistance through ongoing emotional support, education, prevention, advocacy, and awareness to all survivors of homicide victims. My name is Keith Washburn, also the engineer for today's show. I want to remind you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our producer for Jaws of Justice, Jeff Humfeld. Up next is Craig Lubo and his guest.
Okay, this is Craig, and thank you for staying with us here on Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Alex Martinez. He is a field organizer with the ACLU, and that's on the Kansas side. That's correct. And today we are going to talk about, it's a program called Safe Welcoming Wyandotte.
That is correct.
And welcome, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let me have you just start out telling us in general what the program is.
Sure. So the ACLU of Kansas has done its work and look at the state and ask the question, how does a safe and welcome community look like? And so we look even closer at Wyandotte County, and we discover something really troubling. We discovered that one in five people in the county possibly don't have identification. So that's about 30,000 residents, or up to 30,000, or about 19% of the county population. And so when you look at the breakout of the populations, that's about 18,000 senior citizens who live without ID, most of the times because they let their ID expires. That's also around 10,000 undocumented immigrants. And then the rest are folks that don't have home addresses, folks who are coming out of different systems like the prison system or the the foster system. And so there's trouble in getting the right documentation to get your identification. So what the Safe and Welcoming Wyandotte program wants to do is create a municipal ID program to cover those folks. But not only them, this is a program that will benefit the whole county. This identification will not be a driver's license, so it will not give you privileges to drive. It will not give you privileges to travel either, and it will only be valid within the county limits. But the difference is that it is a government issued ID, and you are able to address the barriers that you usually have when you don't have identification, like picking a prescription or enrolling your kids in school or things like that. simple things that we, you know, sometimes take for granted.
Okay. Now, I've heard some people over there argue that this was a first step towards basically providing sanction to all of the undocumented workers. What's the argument?
That is their argument, and the reason they are arguing on that is because we're asking for something that we're asking for an extra thing on this ordinance or this program that we're proposing, and that is the protection of data. So the ACLU strongly believes in privacy. So we believe that the information collected from this program, but not only this program, for any program, should be protected by the government of Wyandotte County. Their residents, their neighbors are trusting the government with the information they're providing by coming forward. And so we believe that it's fair for them to protect that information and not share with any federal agency, unless there is a motive and a warrant, valid warrant to ask for that information.
What are some of the problems as a result of people not having IDs that you hope to address with this?
So last Tuesday I was at Crosslines Outreach Community. And so I was at the door talking to a lot of people who come to the kitchen, the community kitchen, and it was early in the morning, and I was talking to a lot of people. One of the gentlemen that came to me talked to me about the difficulty of having an ID when you're homeless. He told me the great lengths that he had to find transportation to go to a community center, and then he had to wait for the community center to be able to speak to him, for them to write a letter so he could go to the DMV, and then find more transportation to go to the DMV so he could provide something that said that he had an address. So when you go to the DMV, you have to provide an address. You also have to pay for the driver's license or the state ID, and you also have to prove that you're a citizen. So for this gentleman, two of those requirements were really hard. Not having a job, not having a home address, that was challenging. And so we recognized that the system, that is the DMV system, it was failing him. So the municipal ID wouldn't really address his transportation issues, but it addressed the cost, and it will also address the address situation. We don't know what will happen during implementation process, because we identify the problem and we're proposing the solution, but as far as implementation, it's up to the unified government. But we're proposing that they're a little loose on those requirements, because of the requirements are so strict that they become barriers for people.
Okay. Now, you mentioned ID for homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
And at the DMV, they have to provide an address.
Yes.
So under this program that is being proposed, what would they do as far as address?
Like I said, implementation is going to be up to the unified government, and they will decide what they will accept. Mm-hmm. But, there's if they go to the community kitchen, there's some – they can provide a document for them. If they are in a shelter, they can provide a document for them. Some DMVs are not longer taking those documents to say this person is a homeless person and they were served here, or this is their program manager or whoever. Some DMVs are not longer taking those documents. They're only taking documents from shelters, but sometimes shelters are not accessible for a lot of people, and so some people struggle with that.
Okay. If somebody is just a homeless person, mm-hmm. Is staying, and some people would say they're not homeless, but
right.
If they're staying with relatives and friends and they're moving like every 2 or 3 weeks, what would they do to be able to get a driver's license if they're otherwise eligible for a driver's license and they live in the state and they pass and they can pass the test?
Unfortunately, you know, for the DMV, or if you're not living in a homeless shelter, you're not considered homeless. If you're living with relatives, or if you're going from couch surfing or just staying somewhere else, you are not considered homeless. And so it's really hard for them to obtain an identification that way through the DMV.
Is there any litigation that the ACLU has pursued in Kansas or anywhere else that you know of addressing that issue so that people can get a driver's license?
None currently.
Okay. And you said one out of five, or about 20%, don't have an ID.
Yeah.
Besides the people who are homeless, what are the other reasons that some of these people don't have it? I suspect one reason would be undocumented people.
Sure, and so the undocumented people don't meet the criteria at the DMV of having, you know, the citizenship, and so they can't get that identification. And so it's really hard. So some folks from other countries have documents from their own countries, but as you know, sometimes they are not valid here in the United States. And even when they are by their country's consulates, they're still not validated by so many other legal documents that you could use here. And then for some senior citizens that we have talked to, it really becomes an issue when they're no longer driving. Mm-hmm. And so they don't renew their license and they let it expire. And so in Kansas, there's a lot of things you can do with an expired license, but this will be just another layer of protection. And then again, the municipal ID, it's not just for to protect these groups. This identification is for the whole county. It would create a different a sense of community, a sense of pride to be part of Wyandotte County. And so that's what we want to do. We want to bring the community together, because we know Wyandotte County is one of the most diverse and beautiful counties in the country, and they deserve first safety, and they deserve to thrive. And I said the word safety because when everybody knows each other's name, we feel safer. And also, one of the points that I want to make is that having identification will definitely help law enforcement with folks reporting crimes, and crimes that are committed against them especially. We know that there's a lot of people out there that go not reporting crimes because they're fearful of being questioned about their status. So that's, we want to make this community safer.
Okay. Now, when you say they're afraid to report crimes, you're talking specifically about predominantly the undocumented immigrants.
Yes, we're talking about mostly black and brown people. We're talking about, you know, the distrust between black communities and law enforcement, and we're talking about undocumented immigrants, and we're talking,
All right. Because a lot of people who may not call and report crimes are because they're
fearful to be asked.
Well, they have warrants out for themselves. They may be documented in citizens, but they may have warrants for other crimes.
But not necessarily. There's accounts of folks who have suffered crimes themselves, and they have not reported because of their status.
Okay.
And then there's folks who are just fearful of the police, even if they have done anything wrong, and it's just because what they see that has happened. Especially with black folks being killed by police, and so there's a lot of distrust, and so we want to bridge that.
All right, and tell me what the approach would be to help those people gain trust, because I would think that if they are in that situation where they don't trust them, that they would be apprehensive and not trust the system for to apply for the ID.
So we have launched this program since we launched this program back in or the beginning of this program back in July, and we were able to have conversations at the doors with people. And so we knocked in close to 4,000 doors already and talked to people about a little bit less than half of that. And so we're having the conversation with folks, and we are asking for their support. And out of the people that opened their door, about 83% of them supported it. And when we're talking about building trust, we talked about having those hard conversations with people at the door and saying, I will come forward and get this ID because I support this because I need it, my family needs it, or somebody I know needs it. And so, I mean, 83% of people that we talked to supported it. That's a really great number. 83% of people don't agree on many things. That's usually not a number we see when we do polling. But that's a lot of people. And go ahead.
When you knock on their door, and let's assume they're documented that they're a citizen, and they say they're fearful to go get an ID, what are some of the things that you tell them to try to convince them that they don't need to
do? So a lot of the things, a lot of the reasons why someone would say no is because, or when they're fearful, our volunteers or what I will tell them is that their information will be protected. You know, a lot of folks especially with homeless, they just don't want to share their information with government. And so one thing that I share with them is that the information is protected and we're fighting for it to be protected, to not be shared with any other agency. And so the other thing is that it will open more opportunities for them. Some of the opportunities they identify themselves like, oh, I'm going to be able to do this with that. I'm going to be able to rent something with this ID. I'm going to be able to open my utilities or something like that.
All right. So what's the approach to try to get this adopted by the I guess it would be before the Unified Board of Commissioners.
Correct. The Board of Commissioners, yes. So they will have to vote on it. We will introduce this program to each of them and try to get their support.
And has there been discussions before to give you an indication as to, like, which ones already supported and who you need to work on?
Yes. Okay. I'm gonna stop there.
So are you close to getting enough support to?
I think we're close to getting some support. As you know, the midterm elections are taking a lot of people's time, and we're definitely, we know that in the upcoming weeks we will be having these conversations with some folks at the Unified Government, and so we're hoping that it does not take very long from now.
And if this were to pass in Wyandotte County, is this something that would be a sure thing then, or could the state turn around and come in and say you can't do this?
Right. So this is completely legal. We did the research, and we also have some case studies, other cities that we have looked at. This identification program has been done over 24 times in the last few years in different cities. The biggest example that I can think of is New York City. The smallest example I can think of is Little Rock, Arkansas. So it's completely legal, and the courts are on our side on this one. So the state can turn around and do what they need to do or what they want to do, especially if we have a governor who's anti-immigrant. But the law is on our side, and we're prepared to take care of that.
All right. And so you're going out to the community, what, and you're knocking on doors. Mm-hmm. What else are you doing to get this out to?
So we're going to different neighborhoods, and we're talking to different organizations. And we have, so far, we have written a letter to the Kansas City, Kansas mayor, and about 25 organizations from Wyandotte that have signed the letter, and that includes service providers, that includes shelters, that includes businesses and associations, different home associations. And so what we're seeing is a great support from the community. And so if people would like to look at the list of supporters, they can go to wycoid.org. That's wycoid.org, and look at the information. And there they could also find the most frequently asked questions and kind of a recap of what we have done during this campaign.
Okay, and so what have been some of the most frequently asked questions then? What are some of the most
I think you already things? Asked some of them. Okay, yeah, like, so would this be a driver's license? No. Will this be okay. used for travel? No. Will only be valid within county limits? Yes. Right. Something more like that. And you could also find different examples of a lot of research that we did on the other cities.
All right. And if this passes in Wyandotte County, is there a plan to implement this or seek to implement it in other cities in Kansas?
What we're going to do is look at different communities and different and different municipalities and figure out what safe and welcoming means to them, mm-hmm. And then do that. It might be a municipality program, but it might not be that. It might be something completely different that the community needs. So we're gonna take our time researching that, and so we're gonna figure out what that is, and we're gonna figure out where. We don't know yet.
All right. In terms of some of the other legal ramifications, mm-hmm. so they can't use it for driver's license and that kind of stuff. What about for things like Section 8 housing and that kind of stuff? Would that help them in that type of stuff?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the requirements are for Section 8 housing.
Okay.
If Section 8 housing, it's a federal program. Some people might qualify from it. Some people might not. But I'm not sure if they will take that ID.
Okay. What do you expect in terms of, because we talked about how getting them to trust police, statistically, what is the best outcome you think you can achieve in this in terms of how many of those of the 20,000 or 30,000 people you think you would be able to get to go in and actually obtain the ID?
We hope that all of them do, really, but, I think after we win, it'll be important to let people know that, or the people that we haven't reached yet, to let them know that this is something that's available for them. We have definitely done the work to reach as many people as we could so far, and we will continue to do that with our outreach. But we hope that everyone participates, not only the affected communities, but everyone in the county. Like I said earlier, this is an opportunity for the county to come together as a community and get the municipal ID and have pride to be part of Wyandotte County.
Yeah. And you said you're seeking, and I think you've got support from the businesses mm-hmm. in Wyandotte County. Do you anticipate that their support will actually help you?
Yeah, so we're seeing that we have some businesses association as part of supporters. For example, the Central Avenue Betterment Association is a supporter of this movement, and they are representing a lot of businesses on Central Avenue. And so what they would like to see is people coming into their businesses with identification or even just coming to the business period, mm-hmm. you know, like being, like I said, building community.
All right. And does this help, like, with things like banking and that kind
Absolutely.
Of stuff?
Absolutely. So the different banks, not only Wyandotte County, but a lot throughout the metro, require you to have a valid identification for you to bank there, to you to open a savings account or a checking account. So this municipal ID will be listed under a valid government ID. We are seeing that folks are being denied banking because of they have their country's consular ID card. And some banks will allow that. Some banks are not allowing that. Mm-hmm. But I think by having a government issue ID will take care of that barrier.
Okay. And one other group of people you had mentioned at the beginning was people coming out of the prison system.
Yes.
And so is that mostly a case? There is their problem mostly related to homelessness too, or is it a separate set of problems, and how would you deal with that?
So it's not directly or indirectly related to homelessness, but what we have seen not only in Wyandotte County but in the country is that and this is a really, really awful statistic, but over 20% of black males coming out of the prison system don't have ID or don't seek to get or renew their identification. Mm-hmm. And so we're that's something that we're looking at to reach out, to do outreach, to make sure that people know that they, one, they can get identification after they come out of prison, and two, they can, after they're off papers, they can register to vote.
All right, so we didn't even wind this up. We've been talking, for those just joining us, with Alex Martinez, who is a field organizer with the ACLU in Kansas, and we've been talking about a municipal ID program that they are promoting for at least initially in Wyandotte County. Okay, thank you, Alex.
Thank you so much.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The authors of The Medicalization of Marijuana, Legitimacy, Stigma, and the Patient Experience are Michelle Newhart and William Dolphin, who joined us for the Cultural Baggage Show.
Our research showed that, you know, doctors say some crazy things to people around this. You know, we had one patient who, you know, talked to, had a rare form of multiple sclerosis, went to her doctor about it, and he's like, well, you might as well just drill a hole in your head like they did in the Middle Ages.
Oh.
You know, and she had to be persistent, but, you know, she kept going back and said, hey, you know what, I'm trying this, it's working, you need to educate yourself, and he came around in the end.
We had other doctors that we know are out there who support the use of medical cannabis for their patients, or their patients may have known conditions for which medical cannabis is helpful, and but they're prevented from making the recommendation because of bureaucratic limitations. Federal money or DEA licensure keeps them from actually being the one to sign the recommendation form. So even though informally they'll give the thumbs up, they aren't the ones to sign it. And we've seen the laws change around sort of how loose it is to go in for a recommendation, what evidence you need to provide, whether you have to give ongoing care to those patients or not. Another way to see the doctor mill of doctors, so to speak, is that they've played an important role overall in the medicalization of marijuana. And that's because you had to have doctors willing to sign those recommendations to have a functioning program.
Right.
So, you know, without someone willing to sign those papers, you don't have a program that's working.
Right. You know, I knew one doctor, California doctor, very well, Dr. Tom O'Connell, and he took the time. He evaluated his patients. He kept printing a lot of notes. He did some of his own studies, analysis of, you know, who was coming to see him and why and so forth. And, you know, Dr. Tom has passed on now, but they weren't all that nefarious, or what you might say, out in California.
Exactly. Exactly. There's plenty of legitimate doctors who are do sign papers, but some doctors that do end up with limitations either in what they believe or in the limitations that they find from being tied to federal money in some way or federal licensure in some way that means that they're not going to sign papers.
I urge you to hear the full discussion on the October 17 edition of Cultural Baggage. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
1, 2, 3. Nearing my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup, with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.
Myself a bad